Good afternoon and welcome to the Becky Book Show. I'm Dr. Robin Gould, and I'm so excited to be here today to share with you for the next about hour and a half about some of the things that I feel like improve the quality of our life. So just in case you're new to the program, let me introduce myself and introduce what the Becky Book Show is. So first, I'm Robin Gould, and I am a marriage and family therapist. I have a doctoral degree in religious education, and I enjoy attachment theory and attachment theology. That's some of the that's probably the most important thing in my life, my specialty that I like to focus on, and it's the foundation of the work that I do. And so basically everything that I am going to share is going to come from a relational and attachment perspective. So I think that's a very good perspective for a radio show where people are tuning in to listen and be encouraged and maybe even get some practical, helpful hints and ideas for how to apply this encouragement to our everyday. And that's going to be the basis of our show today. It's about applying some principles to our life that will help us in the way that we think, in the way that we are with others, in the way that we act and perceive ourselves. So that's who I am. I live in Florida, where it's beautiful weather right now. I apologize if you're in a place that's still having snownados, as they call them, even though we're in spring and, of course, right here in the middle of unleavened bread. So anyway, but that's where I am and who I am. And our show, the Becky Book Show, is a show that's primarily focused on Becky Books. If you've not heard of Becky Books, I encourage you to do a little research and check these books out. Becky Books, and the spelling is B-E-K-Y. It stands for Building and Encouraging the Kingdom of Yeshua. Becky Books are books that are written in short form, basically a 1 to 2 sitting book, that cover the basic topics and sometimes the not so basic, but we have different tiers of how these books are arranged and categorized to cover the topics that your friends and family have questions about. It's not always easy to share our faith with people who have known us a long time. Maybe they're not in full appreciation for a lot of the changes that we've made. Maybe that we eat differently now, worship on a different day, hold to a different set of covenant vows and rules that are very foreign to them. And they might have questions. They might have doctrinal questions, personal questions. And these can be this can be a controversial area for people with particularly family. And it's nice to have a resource outside of yourself to rely on that's affordable and trustworthy. And that's what the Becky Book agenda is basically to provide you with some tools that you can use that will help you to share your faith in a non-threatening, non-judgmental way. So the topics of our books, we have our basic tier, which I'm actually an author of that first tier. I have a book on marriage and divorce and remarriage in the Bible, which is an extremely controversial topic. Many people have heard for many years that if you've been married and divorced, you're never really divorced, and any remarriage is adultery. And we've heard mainstream systems promote this for years and years. Well, this book scripturally tears that myth down, but in a way that's building people up. It's a book about inclusivity. It's a book about learning how to read scripture, how not to be afraid of scripture, and how scripture is very common sense based by a very loving and merciful God who gives us the keys of his kingdom of earth to operate in it with the proper authority, the proper perspectives, and the most logical and pragmatic ways to live in a loving way toward him. So that book is a jewel and a very helpful book. There's a lot of different authors that come from the same perspective I do in terms of just studying this out in the original text. And this book is just one of them. I think it has a twist in it. It's nice and helpful and takes kind of expands the scope a bit. So I prefer to add all these extra pieces, the relational part, the attachment piece, is what I put in my books. So that's one book that is a Becky book. I also have three other books that are basically focused on the dietary laws. I have Peter's Vision, Beacon or Bacon, goes into depth with that vision and even broadens the scope of the meaning of that vision. Even seasoned followers can even get something out of that book. They might not have known maybe certain details. I wrote another book about the dietary laws called Colossal Controversies, and that basically goes very much in depth with Colossians 2:16, which is one of the common arguments that people will, you know, along with Peter's vision, they'll throw that in about eating anything we want and how the Messiah changed and fulfilled and all of that. We also go further into all of that with first century words revealed to 21st century believers, which is my third Becky book in the trilogy of the dietary laws topic. So you can get these on Amazon.com, or you can get them on my website, which is www.newcovenantpath.com. And I also have a children's book on my website. It's called The Forgiveness Tarts, and that will be going on sale soon, and that will be for sale on my website eventually. That's just a brand new book. So anyway, to just let you know that those are my books. There are other Becky books that are really, really great. We have a book on the Sabbath, on how to celebrate the new moon, on the Jewish sources, what does that mean, truth, tradition, or tear. It talks about tradition, what is good tradition, what was the tradition our Messiah loved, when is it not a good tradition. There's the Hanukkah and Prophecy, that's another whole great book. Oh, that's a two, that's one for probably a two setting book. We have a book about, I'm thinking we just have books that basically span wide topics, that we like to cover, that are questions that you have. And we are always adding titles. So keep looking and keep seeking out the titles. Just even there's a book on the Messianic Synagogue and the service. That might be intimidating to people. And this book helps demystify that. So we do try to, you know, cover topics that are going to be relevant to you and interesting to you. Some of the books are a little easier than others. So check them out. When you have friends and family with questions, give them a try. I don't think you'll be disappointed. The Becky Book Show also, along with featuring the Becky books, we interview the Becky Book authors and try to get to the core of their heart on the matter of why they wrote their book. What sort of feedback do they get about the book? What questions do people have to broaden the scope of the book? And so we like to have them on the program as often as possible. And also we interview other authors that write other books that we appreciate, and we enjoy promoting other authors that contribute so significantly to this arena of learning. And we like to talk about things that pertain to our Becky Book audience. So that's what this show is for. It's for us to just have a little time together and maybe put a few things in order and in perspective. I like to feel like I'm not alone in this journey, and we are meant to be a family. So we have our ways of joining in any manner that we can, and this is one of the ways that we found to be effective, and people have really enjoyed this show. So this program seems to be a blessing to a lot of people, and I'm very honored that I get to be a part of it. So having said all that, in introducing myself and letting you know what the Becky books are and encouraging you to check them out, we'll get started on our program today. And today I don't have a guest. I do for next week. We will be talking with Rhonda Hinson Sullivan, who's a worship leader, beautiful singer, good friend of mine. And we're going to be talking about worship, which is where her truest heart is. She's lovely to talk to and has so much heart on that matter that she can bring you to a greater understanding of worship. Has been very valuable for me in that area of my life, and I have so enjoyed all of my discussions about worship with her, and I wanted that to be shared with you. So look for her next week. But today, I wanted to go into something very simple. We have discussed this before on the program, but there was a bit of a technical problem and it couldn't be recorded. And so I can't put it on our Becky Book archives, which is on the Becky Book page, which you can find on Facebook and on beckybook.com, where we have archived these programs for you to go back to and listen and share with your friends. And this one did not get recorded, but it did get a lot of attention, and it was just the played the one time. So I'm taking a feature of that, and we are going to explore it a bit together. So what I did on that program that people loved so much, sometimes I talk about Musar. Musar are spiritual ethics. And the book that I use, actually going to grab it right here, is called Everyday Holiness, The Jewish Spiritual Path of Musar. It's written by a man named Alan Moranis, and he is actually the founder of the Musar Institute. Now, I'm not using that book today, but the genesis of the teaching that I am going to just, part of the spin-off, we're going to talk about sort of the spin-off of that. But the topic of the Musar topic that I was discussing that day was simplicity. We were talking about something very simple. And actually, maybe it was equanimity. Yeah, I think it was actually equanimity. But one of the things that happens when we do Musar, which is so interesting, and I'm an example of it right now, is that they're all so related. You can almost interchange many of the principles with these ethics because they equanimity and simplicity really have overlapping themes. Compassion and loving kindness overlapping. And that even overlaps with simplicity and equanimity. It's just how this works, because everything is a circle. Everything is connected. That might sound really way too new agey for you, but please don't let it be. This is not anything to be worried about. The Torah is an Eastern document, and Israel is in the East. So there are themes that are very decidedly not Western that the Bible teaches. And so as long as we stay in our covenant oneness with the Father, and we don't diverge out into other gods, which we don't do, there are just many themes that tweak our understanding and are really different for us in our experience, from our Western experience. So that's a little bit of something that maybe you're even trying to share with your friends and family. We talk about the Hebraic mindset versus the Greek mindset. And that's a very big sort of buzzword you might hear if you're new. Hebraic-minded, the Hebrew who crossed over, which is what Hebrew means. Well, there's a lot actually to that. The Western mindset, particularly the American dream, is in many ways so far removed from the way of thought from a biblical template, from an ancient Near Eastern perspective. And that is not our fault. And that's nothing we need to feel badly about. But we do have to tweak our understandings so that our understandings conform to the proper perspective that would be in line with the Bible. So having said that, what I want to talk about today was I have a lot of people very interested in learning a little bit more about what I was talking about the day that we discussed Huga. So, and how that applies in a biblical way. And I think that's such a good question. So before I go any further, you're like, what is Huga? If you've not heard that previous program, what is Huga? So let's just give that a definition. Huga, it's spelled H-Y-G-G-E. So it looks like Hygge or Hyg, but it's actually pronounced Huga. It's a Danish word. And the book that I have, a bunch of books on it, but the one that I'm using today, it's called The Book of Huga, The Danish Art of Contentment Comfort and Connection. Nice little blue book, just quite small. And let me give hygge a definition according to this author, who is Louisa Thomson Britz. Let's get her her definition here, which I think is a pretty standard one. The definition of hygge. Hygge is pronounced hygge. So hygge is a quality of presence and an experience of belonging and togetherness. It is a feeling of being warm, safe, comforted, and sheltered. Hygge is an experience of selfhood and communion with people and places that anchor and affirm us, give us courage and consolation. To hygge is to invite intimacy and connection. It's a feeling of engagement and relatedness, of belonging to the moment and to each other. Hygge is a sense of abundance and contentment. Hygge is about being and not having. That's the definition here of hygge, which I think is just a refreshing, it's just a refreshing idea of dialing everything back into these simple moments of being and of contentment. And I feel like we lose so much of that in the United States. Absolutely lose moments of time in our big endeavors, right? I think in America, many, many times our lives are larger than they should be. Now, I'm not saying don't think big. I'm not in any way trying to encourage anyone one sort of lifestyle or another, but I want you to see the value in the idea of hygge, because I think it's extremely biblical in terms of transforming and being. So I want to read a note from the author. I really like the way she words this. I think she really has an absolute handle on the idea of being, and we can learn something from everyone. I think she could learn from things we have to share, and we can learn from her. So here's what she says, and I quote: "Hygge is a feeling that most of us know but can't quite define. To give a name to an experience is to pay attention to it. Hygge can describe feelings that are already familiar to you. It is there in the rhythm of your daily life, in your habits, routines, and rituals. You don't need Danish recipes or the secrets of a Scandinavian lifestyle to learn how to hygge. It can be found in asking yourself where you feel most at home. What are the activities and customs that anchor you? Who makes you feel at ease? What is it that contributes most to your sense of well-being? What do you do to unwind? What do you do to reach for to create comfort? For me, hygge exists in moments of contentment, particularly at the beginning and end of the day. We hygge first thing in the morning when we light a candle at our breakfast table, make coffee, pancakes, and pack lunches, and when we return home to each other to share a cup of tea, a glass of wine, to sit around the table and enjoy our evening meal." Unquote. I think that's a very foreign concept, and yet it's very familiar at the same time. Let me clarify what I mean by that. The idea of comfort and contentment is something that in America we do strive for. If you just look at advertisements on television, you see commercials where they show people, to advertise something. They show people having fun, running through a sprinkler, relaxing, eating a piece of watermelon. Very simple, relatable elements of lifestyle, and of course it's always seasonal. You have the winter cozy scene, and whatever they're trying to sell you, they're saying, you know, money can't buy happiness, but buy this so you can be happy. So it's a bit of a duality there. But in our American effort based life. I think many people, while the idea of contentment and comfort are in their minds, I don't know that they achieve it very often. Now let's actually add another twist to this, and let's add the religious community into the idea of hygge, right? So the idea of hygge, of enjoying and taking your time making pancakes and just eating pancakes together with your family and just being extremely present in that moment and enjoying it and being thankful for it. There's two ways that the religious mainstream is going to view that. Number one, they'll view it as a positive thing because it's family oriented, it's home oriented. It's not, I'm going to say, worldly, I'm using air quotes there, because in Hebraic-minded circles, you don't usually separate the worldly from the sacred in the same way, because all of life is worship when you're a Hebrew. And when you've crossed over, your whole life is about living in a certain way. It's not, you know, compartmentalizing these facets of your life. But the other way that people might view this as an indulgence that, you know, that almost that the Father's always mad at us if we're not uncomfortable, and that there's no time in these latter days where everything seems to be stressful and prophetic, that pancakes are really not something we have time for. So you're going to get a dichotomy in that with the same group. They love the idea of contentment at home, and at the same time, do we really have time for contentment? When in reality, as a therapist, I will share that if we don't have that, we will find it, right? We will rather than walking in intentional contentment, which is a way that I'm going to share today that is beneficial to you, we will whack-a-mole, right? If your needs aren't met in one area, you're just going to whack that mole. It's going to pop up in another hole. Because people need comfort. They need respite. They need rest. And they need contentment. So the idea of being intentional about it makes absolute sense from a Hebraic perspective. So one of the topics of hygge, or very associated categories, would be minimalism, right? So people might think, well, hygge means you buy all of these cozy items and you feel cozy because of it. Because hygge and cozy are two words that really go together. One really almost defines the other. But really, hygge is about clearing your head, right? And so you're clearing your environment. You're not owned by things. You do own some things, but you're not owned and controlled by your things. So minimalism and clearing out clutter and having more of an appreciation for what you do have speaks volumes toward walking in a contented lifestyle, if that makes any sense, which I think when you hear it like that, I think you are able to really connect those dots. So hygge is not about, you know, crowded houses full of all kinds of objects of comfort. It's moments of comfort that sometimes do employ objects. Like I mentioned, and I was reading the note from the author, lighting a candle. that's one thing that I'm a big fan of hygge, the idea of being present and giving a name to this intentionality. I really like that. Is that I did that with my children. We did a lot of candle lighting. We did a lot of setting apart specific behaviors, specific, I'll call it sacred space, something where we set aside certain things for certain things. So, for example, tea time at my house, you know, I raised my kids with that whole idea of taking some time off in the afternoon to sit, enjoy a cup of tea, maybe have a little biscuit or a little treat, and to just have time to be together. It wasn't something we did every single day, but we did it quite often. And I think to this day, both my kids they're grown men now, but I think they can sit and enjoy a moment. And I do believe that was instilled with my, I didn't even know what Huga was when my kids were growing up. I don't even really know how recent Huga came out. I know I've become familiar with it in a defined way as Huga in recently, but I know that it's always been in my heart to know and to live out. So I think I'm just a natural Huga person. And I think that's one of the things that the Hebraic idea of living really appealed to me. Judaism, in a sense, is extremely rhythmic, ritualistic, planned, and very intentional. And that actually resonates very strongly with me. So here is a saying. It's by Mogens Lorentzen, if I'm pronouncing that properly. And I very much love this saying, this quote. And here it is. It's marvelous to be. One should never be anything else. Now, I think that is so simple. It's marvelous to be. One should never be anything else. It says so much. Because people are always thinking, well, to be what? And it follows up with, just be. Right? It's marvelous to be. One should never be anything else. So the idea of transforming into what you are is a huge Hebraic theme. Who are you becoming? It's not so much what you're doing, it's who are you becoming. And the methods to who you're becoming is based on what you're doing. It might sound like the same thing, but it's really not. Let me read another quote here. This is by Anonymous. The person that wrote this has remained anonymous. It says, happiness is like a butterfly. The more you chase it, the more it will elude you. But if you turn your attention to other things, it will come and sit softly on your shoulder. And I think that's sort of that whole Ruby Slippers mentality that home is always there. You make the home. You are the home. You don't have to go and find that. It's there. And in our lives, we miss the moments. We do. We miss the moment. Kierkegaard says, most men pursue pleasure with such breathless haste that they hurry past it. Huge statement of truth there. Absolutely true. But Huga is when we commit ourselves to a moment. And we don't expect that moment to be anything other than it is, than what it is, than when it is. And what happens is the compilation of these moments where we just be, where we experience, where it's simple and we're not distracted, that all compiled together makes us into the people of presence, of attention, of focus, and of morals. Because when we can settle and calm ourselves, we can operate in wisdom. We can walk in wisdom because we know how to be still, and we can enjoy some solitude. We're not always so busy. We're not the busy one that can never really be sitting with our thoughts and present with our loved ones and connect. Having time, downtime of connection is so important. Just as important as it is that we step out in courage into the chaos when we need to walk out our destiny, we do have to step out of our comfort zone. And this is not an alternative to walking in our destiny. It's a means to accomplish it. It's a way that I believe the Father gives us on this planet, the fruit that sustains us so that we can go out and tell people where the fruit is. And it's very underappreciated in our society. Now, I'm going to say in my circle, it's not that unappreciated because it's becoming a more dominant conversation with members of my family and my friends. And I'll tell you, I have a niece, her name is Gabrielle, and she's just had a baby, beautiful little 3-month-old baby, Levi. And one thing she is my partner in Huga. She completely understands what Huga is. It's in her very nature to embrace the moment and just the way she even describes things to me. She'll tell me a story and I'm just drawn right in, hook, line, and sinker to that story, completely involved, because the way she'll tell the story is she'll tell me about the moments, and she has a way of articulating the moments. And so on social media, she'll put this beautiful picture of her son and very, very cozy moments. She'll just talk about how she was folding laundry on the bed and he was next to her, and she looked at him and felt safe and felt purpose. Just something simple like that. I know that basically on a daily basis, I can get a word of encouragement from her in this way, that she gets it. And there's a certain peacefulness that's she's acquired in her life, and as a mom, that she is really enjoying this baby, and she's not rushing away. I can't wait till he's sitting up. I can't wait till he's walking. I can't wait to hear his first word. Not that she's not excited about these things, but she has an inherent ability, and I'm going to say maybe her aunt Robin had something to do with it, but to enjoy her moments with him. And I just really enjoy listening to her and talking to her. And of course, she's from a horse family. My sister owns a big horse farm, and horse people can be a little bit different. They generally are obsessed with this whole idea of the moment with you and your horse. And like my sister has just beautiful pictures and stories of beautiful trail rides and appreciating that moment and being very present with your horse. I just think there's a reason why equine therapy is so helpful. There's the idea of being present and together and aware. You have to be aware when you're riding horses, and it's done in nature, right? You're riding outside. You've got the wind. You get hungry. You eat food. You feel better. You put your horse away. You tuck your horse in. Your horse grazes in the pasture beautifully, and you can just, everything is just absolutely beautiful with horses. And at the same time, not all of it's very easy. It's definitely a hard lifestyle. My sister wakes up before the sun's up to get the horses watered and fed, and teaches lessons to all different types of kids. And she's just a phenomenal person. But I think horses are a big part of why that is. So there's just this connection that I've learned by watching my sister and my niece live their lives, and how horses and their lifestyle has come out of that, their appreciation of the moment. And so I've really learned to be able to connect these dots with nature. Huga is about embracing time, but not pushing time. So let's think about what this looks like with the different seasons, because a lot of people will picture Huga when we use the word cozy. We are always basically most often drawn to very cold environments. And of course, you think about this is Danish, and I know this is very popular in Nordic climates, because you really have to, right? Because you're limited in your daylight, you're limited in your summer is very limited. But cozy doesn't necessarily mean warm, right? Cozy can be warm on the inside and not necessarily simply a nice crackling, burning fire in your fireplace and your hot cocoa and your soft socks and you're having a moment at book club with a few of your friends, which is very much a Huga moment that I just described to you. But of course, a Huga moment can just be a 10-second moment. It might just be opening up your curtains in the morning, or waking up to the sun, and just having that moment that the sun awoke you. That's a Huga moment, right? You feel cozy, you feel connected, you feel safe. Feeling safe does not mean you're not spiritual. Walking a spiritual life can be pretty uncomfortable. That doesn't mean you always have to feel uncomfortable to prove that you're spiritual. I think a lot of people can very much confuse that. But being comfortable and being cozy, right, it's not wrong. This is part of how we recharge our batteries and our adrenal glands get recharged, and we can slip into rest, and we can provide our bodies with simple pleasures. So it's not always cold Nordic things that cozy things that people think of with hygge. If you think about now, we're in the spring. So hygge is an exciting adventure for you, for busy people that are extremely occupied. Their hours are very precious to them in the day to fit in their work. If they can take time to find hygge in their day, I do believe that this helps you gather your thoughts and become present. But let's think about spring hygge. Let's talk about that. So I discussed a few winter ideas, which there's so many winter ideas about being cozy. Many, just the whole idea of glittering snow or just being, out of the cold into your nice warm house. Hygge in Vermont, where I'm from, there's all kinds of maple syrup, hygge, the smell of the wood stove as you're just driving up the driveway, and it smells so, wood burning fireplace just smells so good outside, and apple picking and just all those things. There are just so many, they're different, more cold weather, fall winter ideas, but the spring is different. So in the Bible, we have the beginning of months in the spring. Of course, we have several new years in the Bible. I'm certainly not going to argue that with anyone, but I embrace all of them because I don't think I need to choose between any of them because there are different beginnings for different reasons. But what I want to do is hygge around them, right? And based on them. I want to hygge in traditional ways to stand in solidarity with Judah, who has the scepter and is the authority that the father gave to Judah. And that is not to be questioned. There's authority there. Whether or not everything is right and not exactly been modified with new technologies where it could be, I'm not even going to put a dog in that fight. But I will say that many aspects of Judaism are very great moments to hygge. But just getting back to my idea of hygge in the spring, wherever you live, maybe you're still in the snow, right? Maybe you're still not able to have that spring yet. But if you think about hygge in the spring, let me give you a little quote here. I love this quote. Actually, it's probably one of my most favorite quotes. Okay, actually, let me read this first one for you. I'm going to read you a couple because I can't choose between them and I'm not going to. I'm going to read them to you. This is written by a woman named Abby Graham. And this is what she says. I open the door. The gorgeous guest from afar sweeps in. In her hands are her gifts, the gifts of hours and far-seeing moments, the gifts of mornings and evenings, the gift of spring and summer, the gift of autumn and winter. She must have searched the heavens for blooms so rare. I just love that. So here she is segmenting, just like I am, spring and summer being more of a typical, more hygge combination, and then fall leading into winter. So, but spring, let me read another quote to you, which I really like here. Let's see. I have this really nice one. Okay, here it is. All right, this is written by Amy Lowell. There's a bunch of quotes I really like by her. But this is a spring quote that I really enjoy. It's so simple, but it evokes such imagery. And this is what Amy Lowell says. Lilacs in dooryards, holding quiet conversations with an early moon. I just adore that. I think about an early moon, I think about lilacs. Lilacs for many people are a hygge moment, just the smell of lilacs, right? Just that is a symbol for hygge. It's a symbol, it really is, because you know that spring is here when those lilacs start blooming. And the way they look, the color is so peaceful. And I am a big fan of lilacs. I think they're beautiful. They attract bees. I don't like that, but I'm really a big fan of lilacs. And I think this, another saying here I want to share with you. This is by Christopher Marley, and I quote, April prepares her green traffic light, and the world thinks go. So there you have an idea for spring. And how do you feel cozy in the spring? Well, spring is a time where you very much can play with natural light much more often than you can in the winter. And this leads me into this other thing where huga can vary from state to state very, very drastically. So I'll share this one piece of huga with you that has been very difficult, challenging for me to embrace. But living in Vermont, we had very long winters and very short summers, beautiful falls that were violently beautiful and tremendously short. Really, it's just a couple weeks that you have that fantastic foliage. And then beautiful summers, but they really didn't last that long, and quite a bit of rain, actually. Vermont's very lush and very green, and when you can be outdoors, you're outdoors because you can't as much as you would like to. Of course, you can do outdoor sports, skiing and snowmobiling and snowshoeing, and people have all kinds of huga around that. But when I moved to Tennessee, where I lived for 15 years, I remember it's one of the challenges for me wherever I went, and this is how ingrained the huga of light is for me, was that people, they close their blinds all in their house, every room, all summer, all winter, all spring, all fall. They shut their blinds and they leave it shut. And they don't, and it just seems to be a cultural thing. Now for me, having been from Vermont, light is very important to us. We have less sunlight. And so I don't know if there's just more an appreciation for it, but it's a way of life. If to have light playing with the objects in your home and the way you have things set up. And so having closed shutters and blinds is completely foreign to me. And I will never, ever, ever, even in Florida where I live now, I never shut my blinds. I don't do it at night. I don't do it ever. Here and there, you know, when you need, you know, to block the sun for a particular person, it's in someone's eyes, or you specifically are changing and need privacy. I'm saying I'll, you know, use situationally, I use blinds, but generally I'm never going to close my blinds unless there's a specific reason to, because that's not the way that I want to experience my environment. Closed up, I feel crowded, and I miss the light. So that's just where that type of huga of playing with light is ingrained. Where I'm going to say a Southern person might find huga in shutting their blinds. They might find a comfort and a shield, like almost like womb space to them, that they're sort of ensconced in this safe environment of home. I don't understand that because that's just not anything I get. Having been a fan of light and what light teaches us in terms of being a northerner. But I'm not going to judge it either, that I can, maybe I don't understand it on its top value, but I can appreciate that space of privacy and of seclusion almost. So I just, to share with you, you know, huga for me and huga for you might look completely different. But when I think of huga in the spring, where, you know, I do a lot of traveling, a lot of ministry, a lot of teaching, I do therapy. These are all really important facets to my life. And slowing down is important to me. So moments of huga for me for the spring, and I'm, like I said, I can only share from my own personal experience and from a few I'll draw from other people that they shared with me for this, specifically for this program, is, you know, quilts on my bed that are very thin and lighter colored. I like white. I'm a big fan of white. And so if I ever lie down for a minute in the afternoon, which is really rare that I would ever do that, but if I ever have a chance to do that, that's a moment of huga for me. I'm in a sort of a bright room with a thin quilt that I'm lying on. And it's very peaceful. And so just from being a little girl, just remembering lying down, my mom, you know, laying me down for a nap on top of my bed with a very light quilt on the bed. And maybe she would put a light blanket over me just to get that huga feeling where, you know, you want, even if you're hot, you want to be covered. So a lot of people prefer to have a cooler home with their air on and then still have a blanket because there's the idea of your nervous system being engaged and calmed to the pressure of a blanket. But that would be huga. So spring huga, right? We have lilacs, we have spring quilts, hanging out laundry and that beautiful smell in your sheets. Do you ever do that? Wash your sheets and hang them out? You think about difficult ministry and just the hard work of the lifestyles that we have chosen and that the Father's led us in. Having these small, tiny moments of respite and appreciation during the day, like just the smell of your sheets that hung outside, actually fortifies your body, calms your adrenals, recharges your understanding of just the beautiful present moment that the Father has given us. He's given us these moments to be present in. So hookah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's not something that you're going to hear in a lot of religious systems. Let's talk for an hour and a half about being comfortable. And that would be really reducing what I'm saying and distilling it down too far. It's not just talking about being comfortable. It's about being present and transformed in that moment to feeling content, to feeling safe, to honoring time as it is and appreciating it. And in the process of that, you accumulate these moments and your life makes sense, not just in the ministry you're in and the job you're in and the duties and the tasks that you have, but in who you are in that moment and appreciating that moment. I think it's very Garden of Eden-y type stuff. We're put in this beautiful garden. We're asked to guard it, right? Adam is asked to guard it, to till it, to tend to it. Well, a garden is beautiful. Was that not the ultimate hookah, right? You're in a garden and you are tending this garden. And just the word garden and just learning about gardens. And, I interviewed Dina Dye, just Dr. Dye recently, about her book about the temple. And she talks so extensively about gardens in terms of kings. They were big gardeners. They was a big, as important as their defense force was their garden. Well, this really gives me some food for the hookah discussion. Gardens are to be appreciated. They're absolutely to be visually appreciated and to stop for a moment and to just take this in, just having a garden. I love that. I love the idea of a garden. So springtime, right? Spring cleaning. We hookah in Judaism with getting the leaven out. It's like you're really getting your house clean. And you're in that moment spiritually relating to what it means for the chametz to be out of your house. And then there's the hookah of Pesach, of Passover, of just pulling out your best tablecloths and buying your decorations and your beautiful flowers and setting your table in an ornate way. Now, some people do a very simple table. There's nothing wrong with that. But there is moments of hookah as we come together and we celebrate the feast. We put it together, right? And it's such a wonderful feeling. I have a huge hookah appreciation for not just the Passover Seder, which is ritualistic and beautiful. And absolutely every Seder is hookah to me every single time. But I don't want to ever forget the hookah in the preparation, in the preparations of putting that festive experience together is really hookah for me. So I think we see that in our festivals, in our feast cycles. There's so many opportunities to have hookah there. And that fuels us and fortifies us to walk into our feasts present and engaged and not harried and overwhelmed, but present and engaged. So important. So these are some of the aspects of hookah that I thought would benefit you today. Living a life of hookah within our feast calendar, our festival calendar, is a way to look at life. It's a way to look at the feast rather than being a burden that come around and take our energy and require us to engage socially where we would rather be more isolated, or all the different things that can make the festivals difficult for people from a Western perspective. I think hookah is a way for us to introduce the moments of these festivals, and giving it a name, hookah, right? Just giving it a name makes us pay attention to it, as I was reading earlier. I like this quote right here that speaks to the point I'm trying to make here. It was spoken by Martha Washington, and she says, and I quote, "The greatest part of our happiness and misery depends on our dispositions and not on our circumstances." Basically, anything that we are living through, doing, engaging in can be a transforming event. It's only the way that it's only dependent on the way that we our appraisal of it, how we see it. Can we embrace this moment? That moment becomes very important, even in its simplicity. While the Bible is not very wordy in all of our instructions, when we think of our Shabbat prep day, when we think of the way that we prepare for our festivals and our feasts, you could imagine that there would be an element of teaching and just the preparation, because that's the way our Father works. He's always speaking, always teaching, and that which He calls us to do is how we are to function optimally. That's a foundational belief that I live my life by. And we learn by doing. We learn by experiencing. We don't just learn by learning. Right? We learn, actually, let me read a quote. Here's another quote. I really enjoy this quote. This is probably one of my favorite quotes of all time. It's by Henry David Thoreau. And this is what he says. "Talk of mysteries. Think of our life in nature, daily to be shown matter, to come into contact with it, rocks, trees, wind on our cheeks, the solid earth, the actual world. I love that, because I think he's just basically saying that the actual idea of nature, of cause and effect, of an experiential moment, like when he says wind on our cheeks, experience it and be, and you discover the mysteries of creation as you experience creation. So it seems so simple. But what I wanted to do today was to encourage you. I wanted to bring up the idea of Huga to you. Maybe you'll go and research it. Maybe you'll look into it and pick up this little book here. It's called The Book of Huga. It's a very inexpensive book, The Danish Art of Contentment, Comfort, and Connection. And the way that I want to tie this in with our Becky Book Show is that the Becky books are meant to be very practical. As much as they're, like I'll say, our second tier books get a little bit more in depth, like the Hanukkah book, The Seven Shepherds and Prophecy, that's a beautiful book by Dr. Aylwine. And that would be like in more of our upper tier, with beautiful practical insights in that book. But it's, you know, going to take a bit more to wade through that and to really absorb that information. And that's a different type of huga. That's a moment of setting apart some time, you know, maybe making yourself a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or an iced tea or whatever is huga for you, in terms of just sitting in a place that's clean and organized and enjoying that moment, reading maybe just a chapter of that book. And in my world, that is huga. Reading in an organized environment with a beverage that I want, that is huge for me. Is that one for you? I don't know. A lot of people that are tuning into this channel are tuning in because they've enjoyed learning about the Becky books. They've enjoyed the topics. Just the simplicity of the dietary laws as a relational and connection point of connection between the father and his children is a beautiful picture of relationship, of a father guiding his children of how to live, how to operate within that ecosystem, and just to trust him. We don't even need to know the reasons why. The Bible doesn't really give us the reasons why the dietary laws are to be followed, but it's very clear that they are to be. Now, we have learned through science all kinds of logical applications of information that would make sense, and it's fun to learn about it. But really what these books do is they don't go into the science of the dietary laws. They don't go into the science of the ecosystem. It's vaguely implied here and there. But the books themselves are us wading through the words from the original text and getting to know our Father much deeper. and just trusting. And ultimately, what is huga from a spiritual perspective? It's feeling safe, close, and connected. Let me go back into that definition that we read in the